On Mondays, we read from your emails. Our show marking the centennial of the New York subway system evoked a lot of memories among our listeners. Stephen Grover of Berkeley, California, remembers when tokens were a dime, the turnstiles were big and heavy and made of wood. He writes, "For a small boy, they were very impressive. I was proud when I could push them a full click without my mother's help." Some listeners love the subway so much they want to share it with the rest of the country. Elizabeth Valsing of Hercules, California, rode the subway for 15 years, and she writes, "I proposed to Mayor Koch when New York City was taking out the old trains to relocate them to other cities so non-New Yorkers could pay to experience the ride. Screeching sounds, lights blinking on and off, hot and sweaty, lurching back and forth. I got a response from an assistant to Koch that said that was not the image NYC wanted to show the world. Too bad." Stuart Clipper remembered a character in Thomas Pynchon's novel V that yo-yoed the subways. In other words, rode them back and forth from one terminal to the other. He writes, "To my young Bronx boy mind, this was a revelatory moment in literature. I gave yo-yoing a go myself, but alas, just didn't have the right stuff." We also covered a new collection of New Yorker cartoons, and many listeners wrote in with their first memory of the intellectual funnies. For Pat Hanavan of Kalamazoo, Michigan, his introduction came in junior high. "My seventh grade English teacher told us his goal was that by the end of the year we would understand New Yorker cartoons. He wrote, 'I usually still do. I can no longer recite Book 2 of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner,' which was his other goal." And if you're not sure what to do with all of your old New Yorkers, James Baldwin offers up this suggestion. "My sister wallpapered her downstairs lavatory with the cartoons from many issues." Few listeners allowed us to overlook a mistake we made last week during our discussion on a proposed bill to allow foreign-born Americans to serve as President of the United States. We mistakenly said that Alexander Hamilton was born in England. Madeline Denko Carter wrote from Portland, Oregon, with this passage from page 7 of Ron Chernow's recent biography. "Alexander Hamilton claimed Nevis in the British West Indies as his birthplace, though no surviving records substantiate this." Well, joining us now by phone to further set the record straight is Ron Chernow. He's the author of Alexander Hamilton. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, and good from Madeline Denko Carter in Portland, Oregon.
So even though there are no surviving records, we're fairly certain that Hamilton was not born in England.
Yes, there's general agreement that he spent the first 10 years of his life on the island of Nevis, that he spent the next 7 or 8 years of his life on St. Croix, and then he emigrated to North America.
And did that mean, a foreigner born, that he was then ineligible to run for the President of the United States?
No, there was a widespread misconception about this. A lot of people imagined that because Hamilton was foreign-born, that he was not eligible to become president. Wrong. Let me, if I may, quote from Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5, because there is a loophole in the Constitution that we no longer notice because it no longer applies. It says this: "No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution, who has also been 14 years a resident within the United States." Well, Hamilton was a citizen at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. He was actually a delegate in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention, and he had been resident for 15 years. So he most certainly was eligible to become president, although obviously he never did.
Any speculation as to why he didn't?
Well, I think that for all of his brilliance and his almost unparalleled achievements as Treasury Secretary, this was a man of strong opinions. And Hamilton was the sort of opinionated personality who goes through life winning legions of admirers and making legions of enemies. You either loved him or loathed him, and I always say he was arguably the greatest policymaker in our history, but he was most certainly not the greatest politician, and he never received a single vote in the Electoral College for president during his lifetime.
Well, from your perspective as an American historian, then, what's your view of the proposal to amend the Constitution, I guess another loophole of a sort, to allow someone foreign-born like Arnold Schwarzenegger to run for president?
Well, I think that the Constitution probably is dated on this point, and I would like to see it change at some point. But I think we should be very careful about the timing so that it doesn't appear that this is really just about Arnold Schwarzenegger. I think that that would detract from the majesty of the Constitution.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
Ron Chernow's latest book is Alexander Hamilton, and he spoke to us by phone. If you'd like to comment on our program or have corrections for us, email is the best way to reach us. Our address, totn@npr.org. Please tell us where you're writing from and give us your name and maybe a guide on how to pronounce it. Talk of the Nation is produced by Setsuko Sato, Becky Vlamis, Megan Moline, Kara Arsenault, and Megan Williams. Brendan Banizak directs our program. Sarah Handel is the production assistant. The interns are Susanna George and Tanya Luma. Kevin Wade is our technical director. He gets engineering help from Burke Hun and Vince Muse. The executive producer of Talk of the Nation is Sue Goodwin. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.